Good morning, good morning, good morning. Much love, good people. If we can find our way back to our seats. Good to be with you all. If I have not met you, my name is Wally. I'm the teaching pastor for Walker Harbor. A couple things as it pertains to announcements. One, next or this coming Saturday, then when we are serving, what it is we were reached out to by the city of Walker, and they say they sometimes have some needs in the community. And what's so cool is we're kind of on their to-call list, which is really meaningful and special. So they had reached out and said, hey, there is a gentleman in the community that could need some that needs some help raking leaves. So Abe went out yesterday and connected with him and kind of plotted out what will that look like, and took some pictures so we knew like how much of it is. And yes, we'll rake leaves because I think it's what, supposed to be 72 on Tuesday or something. Like, we'll get there. Like, it'll be back or something, and then either way we can always snowblow too if need be. But we're gonna rake on Saturday, so anybody that wants to come, connect with me and I'll connect you with Abe. Abe's not here this morning, so, but we'll get it locked in just so we know, have some idea of how many people are going to be there, and then more hands, light work, we'll cruise through it and get that cleaned up for this gentleman. And also within that, there is actually a church across the street from where he was, and so when Abe went over there and connected with him, he also, there were people in the parking lot of the church, so he walked across the street, met the pastor who was newer at the church, let him know what we were doing, and they said, oh, can we jump in with you all? So it'll be actually a kind of a partner up with another church, which is really quite lovely. So they're going to jump in with us as well, and they said they'll probably have some of their utes. Their youth there jump in and kind of do that. So, again, a beautiful thing. So let me know if you want to do that or if you're able. I can get you the information that you need, the address and everything. And then we're going to meet over there at 1 p.m. on Saturday after our bowling time. And then being that we're moving to Indian Trails Camp next week, which is in Amon Park off Lake Michigan Drive, walking trails and everything and how beautiful that is, then where's Linda? Linda's right here. Is the mic back there? Could we grab the mic? Linda had a phenomenal idea, and she wants to invite you all into it as we start gathering next week there at Indian Trails. Go ahead, Linda, and invite the peoples into your goodness.
Hey, so... walking is great exercise, and it's also a great way to get to know people. It's something that physically most people can do, including children or older adults. So I plan on getting to Indian Trails at about 8:30 and starting a walk on the gorgeous hiking trails around 8:45. If anybody wants to join me, I think that that would be a fantastic way for people to connect as a community and get some fresh air before church starts so that we are wide awake and chipper for Wally's sermons. And if nobody shows up, then I'll just have a great walk with Jesus. So,
yeah, awesome. Thank you, Linda. I appreciate it very, very much.
Wear bright colors.
Oh, okay.
If you go anywhere near the outside where people might be hunting, just make sure you wear bright colors.
All right. So get some exercise and let's not get shot.
Whoa, that's great. Okay. That just made it all the more adventurous, did it not? That is something. So, awesome. But yeah, if you want to connect with Linda, she'll be there then. It's just really great to certainly get out in God's good creation and get in a walk. So thank you, Linda, for that. I love that. Yep, so as you pull in the first drive to your right, there is the gymnasium kind of area. That's where we'll be gathering. So if you park there, that's where it'll be, in that first parking area. So if you pull in there, Linda will be out front, ready to go. And we'll be there. There will be a crew of us anyways, kind of there early setting up our stuff. So it'll be good. Thank you. Thank you. That's really, really good. All right, we have been in a series Today actually is, and I don't know if you, how much any, or if you follow kind of the liturgical calendar, but today is the 22nd Sunday after Pentecost. So including today, only three Sundays left in what is known as ordinary time. Kind of in this Pentecost season, but ordinary time before we step into a season known as Advent, which is a favorite. And so Advent is the time where we are actively waiting, if you will, but actively anticipating incarnation, God with us in the person of Jesus. So there is this element that we're getting ready for that. But we have this morning, and we have two more Sundays in which we are looking at seven words. We've been looking at these seven words that are about helping us kind of create whole new worlds, as Abraham Joshua Heschel says it. So in these seven words that we're digging into, I believe these words can radically shift, change everything for us. And it's not the words themselves, but it is what's underneath the words, because they're a part of the biblical narrative. And these seven words are a huge part of shaping the biblical narrative, though. They play a key role within the narrative, these seven words do. And so they help, they did thousands of years ago and right up through today, help people follow, walk with, be with God in more deeply held ways. And so they help us grow up in God in some really fantastic ways, and they can transform our life. And the word this morning of faith. And so faith is the word we're going to look at this morning, which it's a rather simple word, but it sits at the center of what it means to live as followers of Jesus. Yet, the word is used in ways today, a lot of times the way in which it's talked about, it's rather esoteric, kind of ambiguous, fuzzy, or kind of ethereal. Very kind of hazy, fuzzy type of thing. So this morning what I want to do is I want to excavate the word a bit more and kind of get into it and see how those who, what we call the New Testament, those in the New Testament and those in what often is called the Old Testament or the Hebrew Scriptures, how did they engage this word faith? What did it mean to them, or what did it look like for them to kind of lean into this idea of faith? Because we say today, well, you gotta have faith. We say something like that, and you go, well, what does that mean to have faith, if you will? So we've heard this. Many of us have probably talked about our faith. And if you have talked about your faith, maybe that's where you kind of start feeling like me. That's not an easy thing to do necessarily. It can be like, well, how do I explain this? It can be kind of complicated or tricky to talk about. And actually then, as I was sitting down to write this sermon teaching on the idea of faith, what I did is I sat down and I started typing, and I got far, and then I stopped and I deleted it all. And then I started typing again, and I started getting through it, and then I stopped and I go, no, I need to start over. And I was trying to put together just a succinct, simple talk, right? That's how I do it, right? Through this idea of faith. And then I started writing some things down, and I sat down, and then I put together the whole thing, if you will, and I had it. And what I did, and I said, okay, and then I set it aside. And then on Monday morning, this past Monday morning, I brought it back out. And then I sat down, and I read through it, and I went, oh. And I took the end and I put it at the beginning, and took the beginning and I put it at the end. And I said, I think that's what we need to do to maybe unpack this a bit. So that's kind of what we're going to do. So we're going to actually, it kind of clicked with me, like this might be a bit more helpful. At least it was for me. It made more sense. So we're going to actually start with a fella named Paul in the New Testament, and then we're going to kind of pull from what his heritage, his tradition, his ancestry is. And so we're going to start with this guy, Paul, who is one of the first Christians after the resurrected Jesus, who started churches, Paul did, all over the known world at that time, kind of the known world as they understood it. All of these churches that Paul started were in major Roman cities. They were Roman-occupied, Roman-led cities. They were urban. They were highly influential. There were cities where culture was being created and shaped by the best artists, some of the best and brightest minds and thinkers, which is true of Paul himself. So we're going to set the context, of course, and then we're going to sink in so that when we fall into the narrative, the story we will be in with Paul, it'll make more sense because we'll understand how he was sitting in the context of his day. I think it matters. So I'd love to say a word of prayer and then off we go. Gracious God, I bless you for the gift of this time, this place that has opened their doors to us so we can gather this morning and learn more about what it means to walk with you, God, to be with you, to grow in what it means to know you, God, and to do this in community together, which is your church. And so, God, as we now open the scriptures, God, my prayer, as the psalmist is that the meditation, the posture of my heart, and the words of my mouth simply bring honor and glory to you, our Lord, our Rock, and our Savior. We pray all this in the name of the living Jesus, and the church said, all right, now, this Paul fella, he was one of the most educated and smartest within his people. He was, as he even writes at one point, he was a Hebrew of Hebrews. And he was actually positioned to become a rabbi of all rabbis. That was kind of how he was positioned. He was mentored by the great teacher and rabbi, Gamaliel, a highly respected Pharisee, Gamaliel was, who served on the Jewish Sanhedrin. Now, if you think of, like, imagine our Supreme Court with the best and in religion, if they were leading the court, if you will, the most educated and highest in religion leading the court, that's kind of what the Sanhedrin was. Gamaliel was a big part of that, and he mentored Paul. Paul, to him, that was Paul's rabbi, and Paul was being educated, and he was being set up to be the rabbi of all rabbis, though. And then, which is important, because Paul was born in the city of Tarsus, he actually had another really significant marker about him. He was a Roman citizen, which is really rare, as in he was a Jew of all Jews, he would say, but he was actually a Roman citizen, and that is because being born in Tarsus, and this is where it's always, I find fascinating, I think it's really helpful, Pompey the Great in 67 BC, made Tarsus the Roman capital of the region of Cilicia. Then, in 42 BC, you have Mark Antony, he of Antony and Cleopatra fame, right? Mark Antony then declared that Tarsus was a free city. And what's that mean to the Roman Empire? As a free city, anyone born in Tarsus is automatically a Roman citizen. And they cranked up the rights of the citizen to be even more. So Paul being born later, much later than being born in that city, he had citizenship to Rome, to the Roman Empire. So Paul had the best education. He was a Roman citizen. He was held in the highest religious standing within Judaism. And then, after all of this, if you will, he had an encounter with the living, resurrected Jesus, and that changed everything for him. Here's the key. Paul's allegiance, and that word is really important. Paul's allegiance, which is as a very important word, shifted from the Jewish religious system and Roman statehood to the person, kingship, and way of Jesus. Paul now said, my allegiance goes here, first and foremost. It's a big deal. Once then, so now we're going to sink into a story where here's this Paul now starting churches all over. He is in a Roman province city known as Philippi. So we go to a map, and which just helps us, and it's in the region known as Macedonia, but in near Greece. So you have Philippi where you have, and Paul will eventually kind of get a church started there. And there was a woman there named Lydia. And she kind of actually ends up kind of leading the church, which is something, kind of a big deal, yes? But Paul meets up with her and connects with her. She says, I need you to come to my house. I want to host you and your friends. And she persuades them to do so. And then through this, she eventually kind of lead the church in Philippi. But Paul and his partner Silas at the time, they were in Philippi and they have this experience where they're going about, and what ends up happening is essentially Paul subverts a financial organization led by some men who enslaved a woman who had these fortune-telling skills, and she made lots of money for these men. Paul calls that out, gets rid of, like, I mean, what the way it reads is kind of calls out this spirit within her, and now these men are furious because they just wrecked all the money that they were making. Paul and Silas, hey, by doing this now, so now what they do is they actually drag Paul and Silas into prison. They flog them significantly, chain them up in prison while they await having a meeting with the courts. So they're imprisoned, and then this next slide, this is actually understood that what they've excavated the jail cell in Philippi today, as it is that they understand that this is the jail in which Paul and Silas were imprisoned in, that they were held, and the story will pick up there with them in prison. The text is going to tell us that around midnight, when Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns while they're in prison, an earthquake shook the prison, flung open the prison doors, knocked the chains off all of the prisoners, and now you have the possibility for all of these prisoners to escape. This is how the story reads. We're going to be in Acts chapter 16, verses 27 to 31. It says this: the jailer, the guard, wakes up, and when he saw the prison doors open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself because he thought the prisoners had escaped. If they do, he's in charge of them. He knows how this goes. You let the prisoners go, your life is on the line. But Paul shouted, "Don't harm yourself. We're all here." Whoa. The jailer called for the lights, not a switch, by the way, but rushed in and fell trembling before Paul and Silas. He then brought them out and asked, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" Now, before we get to Paul and Silas's response, we need to further set the context. First, being employed by the Roman government, this jailer's full allegiance would be to the Roman emperor. Now, majority scholarship places this story in 51 AD, which means that the Caesar or emperor at the time was Tiberius Claudius Caesar Augustus Germanicus, known to us as Claudius. So in terms of that, Claudius, now here's the thing. He succeeded his nephew, actually, Caligula. And if you remember back to freshman history class, Caligula was someone who ruled with pretty much no morality. He lacked morality and he had an appetite for the extravagant and the frivolous. And so when Claudius comes behind him, Claudius was known for restoring and rebuilding Rome's finances after Caligula's very excessive reign. Claudius was best known for the successful expansion of Rome, ready, into Britain. Claudius actually conquered Britain, expanded the Roman Empire, and then into parts of Africa and the Middle East, what we know the Middle East, expands Rome's empire even more, builds up their wealth even more. He was an accomplished leader who significantly improved the empire's judicial system. And ready, this is important, as in this context, the way we mentioned it, extended Roman citizenship, giving citizens more rights. That's an important nugget with Paul's story, including how this story will end. And we're not even going to get to the end, but Paul's going to basically raise his hand and say, oh, by the way, you beat us and threw us in prison, and we're Roman citizens. And they go, uh-oh. Because you have more rights, and oh, now we got a problem. Now, we won't even get into that. But Claudius was an ambitious builder. He constructed new roads, aqueducts, and canals, which paved the way for Paul's later missionary journeys, pun intended. He literally, by doing this, the Roman Empire paved the way for Paul to more easily and more accessibly get throughout the known world to plant these churches. Now, what's important is that the jailer in this story operated within a system that demanded he give his full allegiance to the emperor and the empire. That's where this jailer sits. Which within that, he would have to publicly acknowledge Caesar is Lord and Caesar is the son of the gods. That was titles given to Caesar. That he was Lord and that he is a son of the gods, or the son of the gods. So in this dramatic moment, it feels like his life has been spared by the actions or kind of inactions of Paul and Silas, and by not running out of the prison and just getting away. He's been spared, and he asked them, what then must he do to be saved? Now, the word the jailer used here, saved, is the Greek word sozo. Go ahead and say sozo. Sozo means to preserve one who is in danger of destruction, to save or rescue. What must I do for that? But here's the thing then. He's not asking about going to heaven when he dies, because that's actually never being inquired of in the biblical narrative. That's not a thing. What must I do to go to heaven after I die? Not a question. He is asking about a salvation and rescue that includes the present while also mysteriously being baked in the eternal. He's asking a big, provocative, wide-reaching question. Paul and Silas respond this way. Believe in the Lord Jesus, whoa, language, and you will be saved, you and your household. So it's fascinating, because in this dramatic moment in which he feels his life has been spared by the actions, or again, inactions of Paul and Silas, he essentially asks them, what leads you to live beyond the circumstantial? He's asking, what does it mean to live beyond what this moment we're in the circumstances we find ourselves in? Because Paul and Silas could have just fled. If it was about just being free, they could have run out. Jail cells open, chains off, let's all go. But they didn't. So this jailer is blown away by their faith and their belief, if you will. Now, this raises the questions that it's important for us. Next slide. Questions. What do these words, believe and faith, mean? What does it mean to believe in Jesus or have faith in Jesus? That's what's being asked here. So we're going to start with the text, believe in the Lord Jesus and you will be saved. The Greek word behind the English words believe and faith, ready, are the same word. Both times, when we use believe in the scriptures, when we see believe or when we see faith, it is the same word. Well, that's not right. That's the Hebrew. Sorry, that's probably on the slide. The Greek word is pisteo and the root word is pistis. Go ahead and say pistis. Yeah, pistis here, what it means is trust, faithfulness, fidelity, having confidence or conviction on. And we're going to get to why that matters. New Testament scholar, kind of the leading New Testament scholar in our day, and we always say our friend, N.T. Wright, he says the best way to kind of capture pistis is the word allegiance. Whoa. To trust or give your allegiance on something or someone. That captures this thing. So as a Hebrew of Hebrews or Jew of Jews, and one who is mentored by a rabbi to be the rabbi of the day, Paul would have likely began and ended his day the same way. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Ve'ahavta et Adonai Eloheika, b'chol levavka, uv'chol nafshika, uv'chol meodeika, ve'ahavta le'reyaka, kamoka, amin. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone, or the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with everything that you are and have. That's how Paul would begin his day, end his day. So this understanding of this is where my allegiance is to love God with everything that I am and put my trust, full allegiance on God, who is Paul's sustainer, provider, and king. Which means Caesar is not. You understand when they say believe, or when they say then trust on Jesus who is Lord, the jailer is saying, oh, so that means if Jesus is Lord, Caesar is not. What they're asking or saying to him matters. So when this soldier asks Paul and Silas, what is needed for me to be sozo? They respond by saying, place your trust on or allegiance to Jesus who is Lord. Great. Except this Roman soldier took out his sword to kill himself because he assumed he had failed Caesar. And by doing that, losing the prisoners, I'm probably going to die. So I'm just going to take care of that myself. So if he gives his full allegiance to Jesus, what would that mean? Do you see why he's not asking some ethereal question? There's something bigger, wider, deeper going on with his question. In context, to believe or have faith does not mean a life of puppy dogs and rainbows then. By this guy saying, if I put my trust in Jesus, life's probably going to get dicier and more problematic for me. Are you with me? So everything wouldn't mean, oh, I guess if I go put my trust in Jesus, my bank account will be full and everything will be up and to the right. That wouldn't be his thought. He's like, things are going to get messy or messier. Paul is not inviting this Roman soldier to say a prayer and intellectually believe some abstract statements so that when he dies, which might be sooner rather than later in doing this, if in giving his allegiance to Jesus, he will float into the clouds and receive a golden harp so he can jam in Jesus' mansion band. That's not what's going on here. Are you with me?
Yes.
Now, let's check out what happens next. Woohoo! So much fun. Then they, Paul and Silas, spoke the word of the Lord to him and to all the others in his house. And that hour of the night, the jailer took them and washed their wounds. Then immediately he and all his household were baptized. The jailer brought them into his house. Whoa. That for him is dangerous. For Paul and Silas, you do not go into the house of a Gentile. But they did. And he set a meal before them. He was filled with what? Fascinating. In this circumstance, in this context, the jailer's filled with joy because he had come to what? Pistis. Trust in God, he and his household, his whole household. A couple things. First, notice the only word to describe what the jailer was filled with is joy. Shocking. Secondly, he took Paul and Silas into his house, washed their wounds, and put on a dinner party, and his whole household participated in this. Because this whole belief and faith thing is communal. He knows this isn't just me. This is about my community, my family. They all, at least we have to start there, that they're going to be a part of it. This entire story unfolds within community. This trust and fidelity to Jesus is lived out in community. It's not individualistic, it's communal. Paul and Silas are cleaned up and fed by this jailer and his entire household. This isn't about one person saying a prayer by himself, but an entire household discovering a new way to be human. And for Paul, a communal faith would be a huge duh. Now, this is where we can go, how would Paul understand this? Well, now let's look at his tradition and the people in which he comes from. So we're going to look at pistis through the lens of the Hebrew scriptures or Old Testament and Paul's ancestry. Now the Hebrew word, the equivalent for pistis, is emunah. Go ahead and say emunah. It means firmness, fidelity. This is just the wider ranging Hebrew meaning. Faithfulness, trusting, steadfastness, and steadiness. So now, to get an idea of what this looks like, we're going to turn to the central story of the Hebrew people, which is the Exodus. We spent an entire year studying that. And so we're going to revisit this story of the Jewish people in the Exodus and a fella named Moses or Moshe. Now, in the Exodus story, when the Hebrew people were journeying toward the land promised to them by God, Moses was found at one point holding up his hands all day long while his people, with Joshua leading, fought the Amalekites. They were in a battle, and there's this weird thing where Moses is like up on a hill holding his arms up. And so in chapter 17, verse 11, we'll begin. It goes like this. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. When Moses' hands grew tired, Aaron and Hur, held his hands up, one on one side, one on the other, so that his hands remained what?
Steady.
Until sunset. Now, ready? The word steady is emunah, that we translate faith or belief. And so here it means faithfulness, steady. When his hands were faithful or steady, things were good. And by the way, he couldn't do it by himself. This story is one that's baked in community. He's got his brother Aaron on one side and Hur on the other. And if he couldn't hold them up, then they would hold them up for him. His emunah, steadfastness, was knit together in community. Are you with me? You see why this is important? Now, so we got this faith, faithfulness, but here we see that the word as reliance or trust and faithfulness on God as a community. It's a big deal. The text tells us that Moses' faith, if you will, on God was only possible with the help of Aaron and Hur. So Moses remained steadfast with Aaron and Hur alongside him, working with him. Now, why I say this? Because we live in an individualistic culture, and sadly, the Christian faith is often spoken about and even understood in very individualistic ways. My faith, her faith. But it's our faith. When Paul speaks of his faith, he actually is pulling from his ancestors, our faith. When you think of the book of Hebrews, it will speak of a cloud of witnesses. That is, all those that have come before us are with us. This isn't my faith, this is our faith. So Moses held his hands up and his, ready? And this is key. Not only did Moses hold his hands up, his hands were being held up by Aaron and Hur. So is so true within our day. It's not that I have faith, but you know what? And then it's those around me, when I just can't sing, would you sing for me? Because I just don't have it in me. But if I can sit here, and if you would sing for me, I'll draw from your strength and faith in this moment. Next, emunah carries a determined, focused fidelity on the faithfulness of God. And I say that with confidence because actually in the scriptures, you know what the word emunah is spoken the most about in the Hebrew scriptures? Not people's faith, but God's. That's actually more in the Hebrew scriptures. It speaks about the faithfulness of God toward and with his people. That's why when you go faith, we say faith, and when we think of it as this really ethereal, kind of abstract thing, well, actually, the scriptures speak of God's faithfulness more than anything else, which is why we are better served with the words trust and fidelity. Two scholars, again, N.T. Wright being one, and Scott McKnight, brilliant New Testament scholar, they together both say, we would do well, I think Scott McKnight said, let's say for a 5-year period, anytime you read believe or faith in the scriptures, we would do well to put in the word trust. take those out, and if we could just have trust in there, we would better learn what's going on here. Because emunah is active and seen, we tend to speak of trusting in someone or in something, but it's actually, and this is where it's important, the way the language is in the Bible, it's trusting on God. Why? Because here's the thing. This chair. If I were to say, I trust in this chair, it doesn't really make sense. But if I say, I trust on this chair, you know how I do that? When I do that action, I'm trusting on this chair that it's going to hold me. That's why it is. I trust on God. I'm trusting on it to hold me. And if I'm trusting, and the reality is if I'm trusting on the chair, I'm not really trusting on the chair. I'm trusting deeper than that. I'm trusting on the one who crafted and created and put the thing together. Are you with me? Do you see why this is really important when we talk about trust and on? It's actually less about the chair and more about the one behind it, which is true then in the scriptures. This understanding of faith or belief can change everything. First, it dismantles the understanding that some people have faith and others do not. Everyone has faith. The question is, what do you put your trust on? Or who do you put your trust on? People put their trust on their 401k. People put their trust on fill in the blank. So it's not do they have faith. The question is where does their faith center? So that's really important. And then everyone has faith. So, and this dismantles the poor labeling system too. And this is where I think it's really helpful. Because again, the word believe, so you go, oh, there's believers and non-believers. No, there's not. Aquin, because what this is about is trust, it's where is your trust? It's not that you are someone who trusts and not, no, where is your trust? So that labeling system's a little bit broken. We need to actually ask the question, where do you put your place, your trust? What on or who on do you place your trust? Better question, more helpful. This is less about checking boxes on a doctrinal statements quiz that we memorize or intellectually agree to, and more about being captivated, ready, by and cultivating a trust of the person and way of Jesus. That's what it comes down to. Do we trust Jesus, which is why one of the early followers of Jesus, a fella named James, writes this in his letter book, if you will. What good is it, my brothers and sisters, if people claim to have pistis, but have no deeds? Their actions don't do anything. Can such a pistis save them? Oh, there's that word save again. Sozo. Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food. If one of you says to them, well, go in peace and keep warm and well fed, but does nothing about their physical needs, what good is it? In the same way, pistis by itself, if it is not accompanied by action, is dead. But someone will say, you have faith, I have deeds. Show me your faith without deeds, and I will show you my faith by what I do. You, now what's the word here? Believe, but that word is actually pistis. You have pistis that God is one. Well, that's part of the Shema. Good, even the demons believe that. The demons trust and shudder. What James has done, though, he's just knit together kind of the definition of trust. He's saying it actually has actions to it. If you say, I trust on this chair and stand there and look at it, he basically says, what good does that? Until you place your rear end on the chair, I'm not buying your faith. Right? So all he's saying is, it's do this. Now, let me try a paraphrase. Paraphrase goes like this. The true test of our faith in Jesus is not like an IQ test of our Bible knowledge, but it's much more like an EKG test of our heart. Genuine faith is not a measure of how much you know about God, but how trusting on God emboldens a love and action for God in the world that Jesus came to save. I want to see, and you can see, how do you trust? Because you, why? Just watch your life. That's a life that trusts on God by how they live and act and breathe and have their being, if you will. An intellectual understanding of faith or belief in ideas or concepts that can be discussed, it can be critiqued, and it can be debated. While an active trust transcends a test that can be graded and reveals a life that makes an impact on and in this world. Active trust goes, wow, that's changing things around them. And that takes us back to how I said Amuna has been really, really difficult to try and type into a sermon because it's best lived out and modeled. If we try and put it into the abstract, it actually gets really fuzzy and difficult. But when you understand it in action form, now I get it. I see where you put your trust by how you live your life. Are you with me? So what I want to do is close with a practice. This, I think, it was helpful for me. I call it a practice, a discipline, however you want to see it. But if you will listen to this practice and think about this. Imagine an average street in West Michigan. Now imagine an average person, I'd like to call her Lucy, who lives on this average street in West Michigan. Next door to Lucy is a Hindu, and on the other side is a Muslim. Across the street is an atheist, next door to them an agnostic, and next door on the other side, someone from Ohio. Now, we're starting to play, we're dancing on heresy, I know, sorry. It's just funny. Now imagine Lucy places her trust on Jesus. Maybe she had friends who inspired her, or she started studying the Sermon on the Mount with them, or maybe Lucy had an addiction. And through a recovery community, she humbly put her trust on God in community for the strength to overcome. However it came to be, Lucy became a follower of Jesus. Let's say she starts living into this newfound fidelity and trust on the life and way of Jesus. She actually takes his teaching seriously that she can become a compelling force for good, Tov, on her street, in her neighborhood, and throughout West Michigan. Lucy then is becoming more loving, more compassionate, more forgiving, more generous. Next, Lucy starts inviting her friends to come over to hang out, cook out, and help her throw neighborhood gatherings, dinner parties, and serve events. Is Lucy becoming a better or worse neighbor? If we are her neighbors, we're bonkers thrilled about Lucy's new faith. We find ourselves more and more grateful for a neighbor like Lucy. In fact, we wish more people would be like Lucy. Now, some basic observations about this average street in West Michigan. The good news of Jesus is good news for Lucy. It's good news for Lucy's neighbors. It's good news for Lucy's entire street. It's good news for people who don't believe in Jesus. So if this is good news for Lucy, for Lucy's neighbors, for Lucy's neighborhood, then it's good news for West Michigan. And I would argue that it's good news for the entire world. This is good news because Lucy's faith is not stuck in her head as abstract doctrinal statements. Lucy's engine is not arguing or intellectually trying to convince her neighbors, street, and neighborhood to agree with or pass a bullet point theology exam. Instead, Lucy is simply cultivating and growing in her faithfulness to Jesus, which means Lucy is living as good news to everyone around her. Which is another way of saying that Lucy is becoming more and more faithful to the gospel. which is the good news of how Jesus is restoring, renewing, and reconciling all things to himself. Lucy trusts. And her trust is found as a brilliant light shining on and into her average street and her average neighborhood in West Michigan. If we are Lucy's neighbors and neighborhood, then we are elated about, drawn to, and mysteriously compelled by Lucy's faith. Welcome to Amuna. What it means to have faith on God, to have faith on Jesus, that the life, the death, the resurrection, the actions, the teachings, the way of Jesus, that's our North Star. That's where I put my trust. I can live this way because I trust there's more unfolding that we can't see, but we can certainly feel. And sometimes you can see when someone like Lucy lives that out and you're like, wow, that's stunning. Wow. I remember when Lucy just hung out in her backyard and wouldn't even say hi or just kind of kept to herself or whatever it may be. And now all of a sudden we're getting invites to dinner parties and Lucy is this glowing brilliance of good news. Why? Her faith. Her trust on Jesus. Are you with me? Welcome to Amuna. I hope you see why this word carries such depth and how it spans the biblical narrative from the beginning through to and beyond Revelation. Fidelity, faithfulness, trust. It's bigger, it's deeper, it's wider, and it's active. It goes, it serves, it gives, it pours out, and it is good news. Gracious God, I bless you for loving us, meeting us right where we are. And when that love, your love, penetrates our heart, when we experience you, Yada, when we have an experience with you, God, and Tov, good, is ignited within us. Your grace, it changes everything. And I bless you, God, for that. You transform, reform our hearts to be as you created us to be. To walk with you in being a dynamic force of good in this world. Because we trust you go before us. We trust that you overcome all the death and evil and sin as it is. You've overcome it, so we walk with you in the new creation. We walk out our faith trusting it's just good news, your news, your gospel, your way, your love in this world. We need that now more than ever, God. So may we be open, even now, hearts, minds, our everything. That we would come, each one of us, and then collectively come to put our trust on you, God. Walk that out in community. God, that as you give us strength, we are there then to hold one another up when our arms are tired. And we need the person next to us. Could you hold my arms for me? May we be that kind of community, a community rooted in you, God. I bless you for loving us, for healing us, for rescuing us from all of the narrow, small ways in which we can get lost. We pray all of this in the name of Christ. Amen.